Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. In this interview, Ken Loach speaks of his beginnings in television and shares his inspirations and favourite movies. I hope you enjoy the show.
Good afternoon, and it's my great pleasure to welcome Ken Loach as our guest today. Hello, Ken. Very nice you could make it.
Hello, Hugh. I'm really pleased to meet after we've had a few false starts, haven't we?
But yes.
We've made it, and I'm looking forward to it.
We got there in the end. So I've got a list of the your favourite films and film music here. The first one on the list is The Battle of Algiers, directed by Gillo Pontecorvo, who did the music with Ennio Morricone, of course. And Ennio Morricone, what can you say about him that hasn't been said already? Remarkable. Now, yes. What is it particularly about this film and this music that you're attracted to?
Well, the film's a remarkable film. It was made in the 60s, and it's about the Algerian struggle for independence from France. And as a piece of filmmaking, it captures the guerrilla warfare by the Algerians in the city, and the organisation of the resistance, and the sense of being there. I mean, it's... It's with a handheld camera, which was a lot of his handheld camera, which was quite new at the time, and it's like a report from inside the resistance movement,
right?
And how they work, and the violence that's involved, and the oppression of the French military, and the organisation of the people, you know, in the interests of getting their independence, and I think it's a terrific film. It had a big effect on me when I first saw it. I think it was it was the late 60s, and of course that was a very political time.
Released in 66.
66, yeah. And I was just starting to do stuff then. I'd done a film about the homeless called Cathy Come Home.
Right.
Where we'd use this similar kind of verite filming. So to see, you know, a great Italian director like Pontecorvo.
Someone else doing it as well.
Doing it, but doing it much better, and doing it in a full-length feature film was really exciting.
Yeah. I found out some things about this, and that it was based on a book by an FLN commander. And
yes.
And then after the conflict, he became part of the new government, which is quite a nice happy ending for him. The man
yes.
who wrote the book, Sadi Youssef.
Yes.
And apparently the Pentagon screened it in 2003, citing that it illustrated the problems faced in Iraq.
Yes. I think guerrilla warfare is guerrilla warfare, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how if an army has the support of the people, or resistance couldn't have the support of the people, it's very difficult for an occupying army to deal with it.
Exactly.
Because you don't know, you know, there's all the people, and there's a, how do you know who's supporting the resistance and
yeah.
who isn't?
Yeah.
So it's a brilliant piece of work. I mean, it's by far the best film that Gillo Pontecorvo ever made, I think. And I got to know him later in life, because he ran the Venice Film Festival.
Okay.
And he was very supportive, and a lovely man, quite small. He'd been in the Italian Communist Party after the war. In fact, he might have even worked with the partisans during the war.
Right.
A very twinkly little man, very self-deprecating, a great sense of humour, and a very good supporter for what we were trying to do.
Okay, well, let's play a bit of music from The Battle of Algiers, composer Ennio Morricone and Gillo Pontecorvo.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you, Ken, a question that I ask all my guests, which is, can you remember the first film that you saw when you were a kid or whatever that really motivated you to think, this is what I want to do?
I wasn't struck on films at all. I mean, I was brought up in a town called Nuneaton in the Midlands.
Warwickshire, right?
Warwickshire, yes, North Warwickshire. The Warwickshire coalfields, really. And I was stage struck as a kid. I mean, the theatre was my big passion from the age of 11 or 12 onwards.
So were you acting in school productions and things?
Yes, all the things kids do.
Great.
We lived quite near Stratford-on-Avon, so I would cycle the 30-odd miles or something to Stratford and see all the great actors of the time, Olivier and Gielgud and Ralph Richardson and Peggy Ashcroft and doing Shakespeare, which was, as a kid, it was a magical thing to see. And the cinema was rather, I didn't really go that much. I wasn't passionate about it. I mean, we had five or six cinemas in the town at the time, and now we have none, of course. But I first got to like cinema when I was more 17, 18. Mm. And we had a cinema in Dunedin called the Hippodrome. It had been an old variety theatre. Mm-hmm. And they used to put on the foreign films there, which tended to have ladies without their frocks on. Mm-hmm. So the 17-year-old, 18-year-old gang that I was with, whose hormones were kind of raging at the time, thought that this was, they could combine art and and lascivious inquiry at the same time. So we used to go and watch these films, and I watched some there, and I mean, quite what we thought was a naughty film, but of course it wasn't naughty at all. In retrospect, it was a film called La Ronde, which is based on the
beautiful film
Arthur Schnitzler play, I think.
Yeah,
and it's like a daisy chain of
relationships.
Not physically, I hasten to add.
No,
but like the boy meets the man meets the woman meets another man, the man meets another man,
and it goes around in a circle.
Yes, and you come back. And so the idea is quite decadent, but the reality was more what I remember, men and women speaking in rather elegant rooms to each other. Those are the films we used to go. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe cinema is interesting after all.
Right. Well, that's a perfect opportunity for us to play something from La Ronde. Thank you. that's The La Ronde Waltz from La Ronde, directed by Max Orfels, composed by Oscar Strauss, and nothing to do with the other family of Strausses, although he was Viennese. In fact, he changed his name so to distinguish himself from the others by taking the last S off.
Yes.
Now, you just recalled that you saw that must have been in about 1951, which was very soon after the film was released in 1950, and that's surprising, isn't it?
Well, it would have been early 50s, definitely. And, I mean, what is remarkable is that this town of, you know, unremarkable industrial town in the Midlands, you would see the European films as a matter of course. They'd be there. And whereas now, of course, that you don't have that opportunity. In fact, there isn't a cinema in Nuneaton. There's one on the outskirts. Right? And it's a town of, what, 80,000 people?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's a cinema on the outskirts, but it's not in the town.
Yeah.
And it's a good example of how competition kills choice.
Yes.
Because what we're told is, you know, competition gives you diversity. Actually, the opposite is true. Because because what happens is, you know, monopoly, isn't it? One sort chain takes over another chain, which takes over another chain until you have no variety at all. And the people in that town now just don't have the chance to see the diversity of films that we had way back in the 50s.
Yeah, and they're dictating taste, these chains.
Absolutely.
Rather than allowing people to make the choice themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there'll be 8 or 10 or 12 screens in one cinema, but two or three of the screens will be showing the same film.
Yeah, if the demand is there, they'll just take over more and more screens.
Yeah. And so, you know, we had such a rich tradition of filmmaking in Europe, and it's being squeezed out.
Yeah. Well, that film in itself had an amazing cast. I mean, Anton Walbrook at the top with Simon Signoret, of course, but then you had Jean-Louis Barrault appearing in it, and Gérard Philippe, my God, Simone Simon, which, I mean, what an amazing cast. Yes. I mean, Max Orfels must have been a pretty big figure to attract those people in that at that time.
Yes, one of the greats of European filmmaking, really.
And it was
made, as you say, after the war, but it was a period film, I think. So it was, and hence that kind of, you know, turn of the century.
Yes, and I think one of the characters is a Prussian prince, isn't he, or something, or an officer. Towards the end of the film.
I don't remember.
I only remember because I saw it a few months ago.
I haven't seen it over 60 years,
wow.
So my memory is a little vague.
Wow.
But it's more the it wasn't so much the film, it was that time where you could see films like that, and Italian films, the Italian neorealist films, you know, De Sica and
Rossellini and people.
Yes.
Amazing. And in Nuneaton.
And now, you know, there is nothing.
Yeah.
But it's the ambience of the cinema, which was, of course, was smoky.
Yes. It
was the fact that you were taking a girl, if you were lucky, you know, all of 15 or 16 or 17, and that awful moment when do you put your arm around the back of the seat? And if you do, after 20 minutes, have you got a crick in your neck?
Yeah, and can you feel your arm?
Yes, exactly. Or anything else. And so, so it was the comedy of teenage girlfriends and boyfriends that it evokes for me as well.
Okay, well, let's move on now to, I see here you've got one of my favourite films. You mentioned De Sica just now, and you've picked Bicycle Thieves. Mm. This is, of course, a marvellous film from 1948, and here's the main theme.
Thank you.
was the main theme from Bicycle Thieves, directed by Vittorio De Sica, composed by Alessandro Cicognini. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And that's from 1948. So I guess that would have been another one of those films you might have seen in the Hippodrome in Nuneaton.
Could well be. I mean, I only became aware of it when I saw it again much later when I was a student in the late 50s, 60s. Then, you know, when I was more aware of what it was about. Because it's in the time of great poverty in Italy after the war, and a man desperate for work, and his bicycle is taken, you know, the means that we can get around.
So he loses his job.
He loses everything. Yeah. And it's from a seemingly insignificant event, the disasters that unfold, but bedded against a background of poverty and unemployment. And so what's great about it is that you see the whole problem in microcosm, or the whole situation in microcosm. A bicycle is stolen, and
the
cumulative disasters are terrible.
Families affected and everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a great model for filmmaking, I think.
Good. Alessandro Cicognini, I apologise if I pronounced that wrongly, he's associated with a large number of De Sica's films regarding the music. Now, I wondered, obviously this happened because they got on well. Obviously, De Sica and Cicognini seemed to relate together, and so they ended up working there. Do you have that relationship in your filmmaking, that you have a great team of people, like, for example, with the music, and they are loyal team that stays, that you love working with?
Yes, absolutely. And the composer I've worked with for over 20 years now is George Fenton.
Of course,
we've done film after film together, and I've been really lucky. But in principle, I mean, the kind of paradox of filmmaking is that on the one hand, you want a film to have a single voice, you know, like a book or like a painting or something. You wanted to have a single creative impulse, but in fact it's made up of lots of different crafts. You know, there's the writer, the principal creator, then you've got a cameraman, you've got actors, you've got the sound recordist, you've got the editor, you've got the composer, the designer for that. So you've got to bring all those find people who share your sense of what it should be, you know, the aesthetic sense, to use posh words, and make certain, weld them into a team.
Really. Try to make it all work together.
And if you get a gang that works well,
you might as well stick
with them.
Yeah, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the producer, of course, I should add to that, crucial. Mm. So, I mean, I've been really lucky and had a team. We've just been together for a long time, and you know, occasionally somebody moves on to something else, and you have to find another. It's like a football team, really.
Yeah,
got to keep the team going.
But your acting, the cast, that's sort of a slightly more flexible, isn't it?
Oh yeah, no. With that, a cast, you've got to find a new cast for each film.
Yeah,
because you've got to find people who, because every part is different.
Mm.
And you know, the location, everything is different. Mm. So you've got to find a new cast for each film.
Yeah, but then again, going back to those European films in the 40s, 50s, you'd find directors there that would stick with the same leading man again and again.
Well, they had their own star system.
Yes.
They were working with the European stars. Really.
Yeah.
Like the ones you mentioned in the Max Ophuls film.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Okay. Well, let's move on to your next choice, if we may, which is quite a modern film. It's The Golden Dream. Now, I confess I haven't seen this yet.
It
came out last year, apparently, directed by Diego Quemada Diaz.
Yes.
And could you give us an idea of why you, and we'll talk about music afterwards, so what attracted you to bring this on?
Well, I found all the films I was choosing were quite old, and I thought, you know, we've got to have a contemporary film in. There are one or two I could have picked. There's my friend Ithia Bayén, who's a Spanish director, has made some wonderful films, and so there was her film. But Diego, who made this film, worked with us on Land of Freedom. He was worked in the camera department. But he's made what I think is one of the best films I've seen for years. One of the best I've seen for years. And it's about a group of kids in Latin America, and they're trying to get into the States, and they go through really shocking adventures and mishaps to get to the border and to get through. There's two boys and a girl. The girl gets kidnapped, and you kind of have an awful horror of what's going to happen to her, but you don't see it. The kids are just try everything in the most dangerous things. They ride on top of a railway coaches. They get robbed. They go through everything from sheer poverty. They go through everything. They get into the States, and they're doing them like the most exploited dead end jobs, and everybody's mercy. And it's absolutely true. I mean, he did brilliant research. His research is absolutely solid. So when you see it, you're seeing what really happens. And a lot of the shooting is bedded into the real people who are trying to get into the States. And at several points they could just get shot.
Right.
But people, you know, are desperate to escape the poverty or the gang or whatever. Yeah. Gangs or whatever. And it's a brilliant piece of filmmaking. So that's my pick.
Good. Well, let's hear a bit of the main theme from The Golden Dream. Thank you. that was the main theme from The Golden Dream, directed by Diego Quemada Diaz. It's his debut feature. And the music was composed by a couple of guys who actually are based in Mexico, Jacobo Lieberman and Leonardo Heiblum, who've got an amazing list of soundtracks and scores to their names.
Remarkable. Right, I didn't know that.
One of them's Mexican, one of them's Argentinian, and they're based in Mexico City. But with names like that, you wouldn't expect them to be Mexican. What I wanted to ask you from that is that you seem quite taken with some of these places in the world where there's a lot of difficulties for people, and obviously where there are difficulties there are stories. And I know that you've said a couple of your films abroad. Do you on the main make your like prefer to be working in the UK when you're making a film?
Well, it's a lot easier to work in a place where you know the culture, mm. and you know the language, and you know the nuances of the language, and you know what things mean, and you can read a situation. You know, you go abroad, and you're sometimes struggling to understand that who's doing what to whom, and what are the subtleties of the power relationships in a situation, and so on. So I think you do better work if you work at home. But just sometimes the stories are so big.
Like the one in Spain.
Yes, I know the conflicts within the Republican side on the Spanish Civil War, for example. I mean, it was a story of such significance. It affected the whole of the history of the 20th century. So you can't do that in England. You've got to be in Spain.
Couldn't have done that in Derbyshire.
No, you couldn't. You'd struggle. And it's a matter of historical record anyway. Mm. So there we went to Spain, we went to Nicaragua to say something about the Sandinista period and Los Angeles even, which seemed the most foreign territory of all to us, and did something about the Mexican cleaners there, struggling for a trade union. Mm. But by and large, I think you make more nuanced films in your own culture.
Right, okay. Moving on to your next choice. Well, when I saw it, I'm sure it was called Closely Observed Trains, it's listed here as Closely Watched Trains.
No, Closely Observed is. Closely Observed.
Yeah, directed by Jiří Menzel. Now, he's a member of the Czech New Wave filmmakers. And what is it about this that you like particularly?
This is a lovely film, really beautiful film. It's set in a railway station during the Second World War, and it's a young clerk who's getting his first job, and he's watching these trains go through, and of course they're carrying people to the camps and soldiers, and it's all the paraphernalia of war and the consequences of war. But he's concerned with growing up, he's concerned with his girlfriend, there's one of the clerks in the one of the other workers there who takes him under his wing a bit, and you've got the local officials and their pomposity, and the girlfriend is much more advanced than the boy is, and it's a delightful comedy of human vulnerability in a young lad and his first job. Very funny. There's some hilarious scenes in it.
And going on against this macabre backdrop.
Yes. And it has quite a shocking end. But it's the whole style of the Czech cinema. We learned a lot from. That's the cameraman I worked with, Chris Mengers, at the time. Chris had worked as an assistant to the one of the Czech cameramen, and learned a lot from him about lighting, about lenses and technique, really, for observation. You know, and that's what I've tried to do always, is just observe what's happening, not make it melodramatic, just let things unfold in front of the camera. And we learned a lot from them. And this film, I think there's another film coming up as well, this film, Closely Observed Trains, by Jiří Menzel, based on a book, but I met Jiří Menzel a few times, and he's a very he is like his films, very wry, very humorous, makes you smile, does daft things, and has a lot of warmth, a lot of great warmth and humanity in the film.
Mm. Okay, well, let's hear the main theme from Closely Watched Trains. Was the main theme from Closely Watched Trains from director Jiří Menzel, and the composer was Jiří Sust, and he wrote the music for 12 apparently of Menzel's films. So there's another example of a director and a composer a long relationship together. I wanted to ask you now, we've got a very curious choice here, because when we were formulating this this meeting today, you asked very much to have a George Formby inclusion. So I wanted to go into that, and I was curious about that.
Well, the earliest films I think I must have seen were George Formby films.
Right,
okay. And when I was a kid, we used to go to Blackpool for our holidays once a week. In Blackpool, and sit on the sands in the cold weather, and the old fella going on in his lace-ups and socks, which never were taken off, and of course the big attraction were the shows on the piers, and the whole thing was epitomised by George Formby.
Did you ever see him perform?
Yes, I did see him perform, but I'm not sure I actually saw him in Blackpool. The big attraction in Blackpool was Frank Randall, who was a who was a comic whose whole comedy was based on wind and flatulence.
Oh, okay, like Le Petit-Man in France.
Yes, but it was absolutely. He did two characters. He did the dirty old hiker and the dirty old man in the pub, and I mean they were both the same character. And he took his teeth out and would reduce an audience to absolute hysterics by wind, really.
Really?
Never the way of putting it, and it was hilarious, and it made with sort of guttural sounds and spits but he was hilarious. I mean, my old man didn't laugh a great lot, but
he liked
confronted
that.
With Frank Randall, he was paralysed, and the old lady there would be tears running down their eyes, and the whole audience were absolutely incapable through laughter. And George Formby, in a way, was the respectable side of Blackpool humour, and Frank Randall was the unacceptable side. But Formby made films, obviously, and so and I saw him, I think I saw him in Blackpool, I can't quite remember. I know I saw him on tour at home, But I had his records and I saw some of his films.
And
but
would he, when his audiences, would there be screaming women throwing knickers on the stage?
No.
He wasn't a sex object then?
No, not really. That didn't happen in those days, really.
Yeah.
Not in Nani.
Okay. So he was just good fun and good clean fun.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's a lot of double entendres in it. You know,
exactly.
With my little ukulele in my hand and
exactly.
Auntie Maggie's remedy and,
yes.
and I'm cleaning windows and you should see what they get up to.
Well,
and that. So I mean that was part of the that was part of the twinkle as well.
Naughtiness, titillation.
Yes.
So we're going to play "When I'm Cleaning Windows"
Absolutely.
From "Keep Your Seats, Please," written and performed by George Formby. From 1936.
The year of my birth.
Now I go cleaning windows to earn an honest bob. For a nosy parker, it's an interesting job. Now it's a job that just suits me. A window cleaner you would be if you can see what I can see. When I'm cleaning windows, honeymooning couples too. You should see them bill and coo. You'd be surprised at things they do. When I'm cleaning windows, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. The blushing bride, she looks divine. The bridegroom, he is doing fine. I'd rather have his job than mine. When I'm cleaning windows, the chambermaid, sweet names I call. It's a wonder I don't fall. My mind's not on my work at all. When I'm cleaning windows, I know a fella such a swell. He has a thirst that's plain to tell. I've seen him drink his bath as well. When I'm cleaning windows, oh, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. Pajamas lying side by side, ladies' nighties I have spied. I've often seen what goes inside when I'm cleaning windows. Famous talky queen, she looks a flapper on the screen. She's more like 80 than 18. When I'm cleaning windows, she pulls her hair all down behind, then pulls down her never mind, and after that pulls down the blind. When I'm cleaning windows, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. An old maid walks around the floor, she's so fed up, one day I'm sure she'll drag me in and lock the door. When I'm cleaning windows, when I'm cleaning windows.
There we have it, George Formby, "When I'm Cleaning Windows." And in fact, although you said he was the acceptable face of
Blackpool humour,
in fact, the original lyric on this was actually banned by the BBC.
Yeah,
it said, "Now lots of girls I've had to jilt, for they admire the way I'm built. It's a good job I don't wear a kilt when I'm wearing cleaning windows." So, I mean, so he got on the bad side of that. But I was just thinking about this, that... there's always a double meaning in all his, a naughty meaning in all his lyrics, and in a way he's sort of a precursor to rock and roll, because all the early rock and roll stuff in America was all this double entendre stuff. So so I'd never thought of George Formby as a precursor to rock and roll before.
Well, I mean, that whole joke really runs through English literature, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
It's all in Shakespeare and Chaucer, I think, as well. So, I mean, it's got a long cultural heritage, the double entendre.
Exactly. That's great. Now I'd like to move on to your next choice here, which is A Bout de Souffle, the film Breathless,
yes,
from 1960. Jean-Luc Godard's classic, of course.
Yes.
Composer Martial Solal. And could you say something about this for us?
Well, I mean, this was, in technique, this was a revolutionary film. Revolutionary in its editing and in the way it sort of chopped up celluloid. So that instead of like the smooth narrative, you were just being presented with different fragments of celluloid
and jump cuts and things like that,
which were very kind of very abrasive and very different. And two beguiling central characters, Jean-Paul Belmondo and Gene Seberg, and a kind of relationship between them, and. I think it's interesting. I think I found him less interesting as he got older.
He just made a new film that's about a dog that's got great reviews, hasn't it? I haven't seen it.
Well, I think it's got more and more intellectual and less connected to people's perception of the film. But it's only a personal opinion. But this the first film, Breathless, is just has a kind of verve and an energy and a wit about it that I think is just fantastic. Mm. And it certainly made us reevaluate what we thought a film should be and how it could be made.
Mm. And when did you make your first feature?
First feature I made in 66.
So a while after these French New Waves had come out. So it was about when the Czech New Wave was happening.
Yes, the first film I did, it was called Poor Cow, but it wasn't. I made a lot of mistakes in it. A lot of unassimilated influences, you know, like you do when you're beginning. And the second one was, 2 years later, was Kes. And that we got our heads a bit straighter on how to do things then.
Mm. You got it right there, didn't you?
Well, it was a number of things came together which worked, whereas I hadn't quite got them to work in the other one.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear the theme to A Bout de Souffle. And that was some of the music from Abou de Souf, composed by Martial Solal for Jean-Luc Godard's film. And Martial Solal, an Algerian jazz musician, and probably a lot of that was improvised. I mean, I can hear something of, you know, Dirty Harry, which came, Dirty Harry music coming from that, you know. Yeah. So it's amazing how influences will, you know, that's probably improvised piece of music, and someone hears it and gets inspired to do something else.
Yes. Well, I think, I mean, the French New Wave, particularly that film, in a way, it sort of quoted American films and gangster films, and the way people walked, and the kind of the code, you know, there's an evocation, albeit in a very critical way, a kind of evoking of certain elements of American films.
Yeah. When you finished shooting and you're going to score your film, get the music, does George have a complete, George Fenton, does he have a complete carte blanche, or do you sit down and discuss the film with him, or what's the process there?
Well, usually we don't show George anything until we've got almost the final cut of the film. And then George is a very... instinctive. I mean, he works very instinctively initially, though he's very obviously technically very adroit and skilled. But it's the initial response to what he sees that gives him the biggest kick, I think, in order to know, have a sense of what sounds and what textures and what's going to be the musical voice of the film. But then the editor Jonathan Morris and I sit down, and we do a list of where we think the music might be.
Okay.
And then George comes in and we go through that, and he'll have other ideas and we'll amend it. Mm. And then George gets some thoughts on what kind of instruments he might use, or sounds, or musical idiom he might use. And then that's what we spend most of the time on, is actually what's the sound you want to hear alongside that film? Mm. Because the wrong sound can invalidate what the film is. You know?
Yeah.
You have a realistic performance, in a realistic setting, saying realistic things, and the music can say, hang on, this is a bit of fantasy.
So you aren't quite completely linked while the music is being done.
Yes.
And it's collaborating, and you're saying, what do you think about this here? And you're saying, well, I'm thinking this.
Yes. I mean, but George is the creative impulse. Mm. You know, I mean, it's his work. But it's very much and there comes a point after we've chatted backwards and forwards and we've lighted on a particular sound and or colour palette, I suppose, that he wants, and then he'll just write some pieces, and then we'll meet and talk it through.
And you can say, oh, I like that one better than that one.
Sort of. I mean, I wouldn't put it quite as crudely as that. I'd say, I think that's really good, and maybe we should listen to that one again. He's terrific because he's a real collaborator in the sense that he wants to work together rather than saying, this is my art and don't touch a note of it.
Well, I think working on a film promotes that sort of activity, doesn't it, rather than being prima donna-ish about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, he's terrific, George, and he tells a good story too.
Well done. So moving on now, we've got a film with curious choice, because this film, there's only a slight bit of music in this. It's The Red and the White.
Right, I've forgotten that.
1967. Yes. Directed by...
Miklas Yangsu.
And the only music in the film, which is written by an unknown composer, is right at the end of the film.
Right. Oh, dear.
But don't worry, because it's an interesting film. I haven't seen it. It's about the Russian Civil War.
Yes.
The Reds against the Whites. The Tsarists against the Bolsheviks.
Yes, yeah.
And could you tell us something about this?
Well... I mean, the reason it's stuck in my memory is that it's very austere, made by this Hungarian director, Miklos Yangtze, and he made a film, I think it was called My Way Home, initially, And I just love the landscape and the confidence of the film, which is, it's quite silent. It's very, it's quite empty, sound wise, and it's very much about the landscape, the peasant faces, their interaction, their stoicism, their dealing with the conflicts they have and the difficulties they have. And it sounds rather bleak, and it, in some ways it is, but it's, I found it very moving at the time. I was, when The Red and the White was, I think, was his best film. Mm. And you say it is these two, this war after the revolution in 17, Western intervention. I mean, people talk about the Russian Revolution as there was a great bloody event, but it was only, the battles came because people intervened, you know, the West intervened. Otherwise it wouldn't have been so bloody, but people forget that. But the camera work isn't the kind of camera work I do now at all, but the camera was always moving. It was very much like high shots where you see masses of people moving across the landscape. Mm-hmm. And then the just the texture of their faces, and the images of it have stayed with me where other films haven't. Mm-hmm. I think you had a real sense of a people and a peasantry that, and the struggles and the toughness of their lives, like before our modern culture of where everything is instant. There's a strength and a dignity to this, which is brilliant.
Would you have seen this soon after it came out?
Or So I think, I don't know if you found this, but that all the influences you have are when you're young, you know. Mm. Once you've had them, then you've got to dig out your own way forward. You've got to forge your own
path. You're stuck with those influences the rest of your life, aren't
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you're just trying to chisel away what you do.
Yeah.
But you tend not to get knocked sideways later.
Yeah.
So, but the things you remember are the early ones you saw.
Yeah, I agree. So let's play the ending theme from The Red and the White.
I think one of the things that you kind of learn from films like that is just the courage to be simple. Mm. You know, you don't need the massed ranks of a big orchestra to have a cinematic effect. And it's a long time since I saw the film, but I think it's because he made the film with such confidence, it gives you the courage to be spare and sparse and economical. And it can have a more powerful effect than lots of added things and you know, fast editing and noisy sound effects and big music, you know, the courage to be simple and economical can be far better than throwing everything at it.
Great, good, well said. Next one on the list is a film called The Tree of Wooden Clogs, 1978. Directed by Ermanno Olmi.
Yes.
And I read up on this, so it sounds like a film I'd really want to see. Al Pacino's favourite film, apparently.
Was it? Oh, right.
Apparently. Yeah. And Mike Lee has also praised it.
Right.
So,
I'm in good company then.
Yeah, what can you tell us about this film?
Well, it's made by a man called Ermanno Olmi, an Italian director. I worked with him, Matty. We did a film in three parts with three different directors. It was him and me and a man called Kiarostami, an Iranian director. This, I think, is Ermanno Olmi's kind of major film. And it's kind of sounds like I'm really only bringing films about hardship, but it's about the daily lives of a peasant family in Italy. I think it's in the north, actually. This struggle to get to school, to earn a living. Maybe I shouldn't have put it alongside The Red and the White, because they say the same kind of things about both of them. The value of the film is in the struggle over small things. Mm. It's well, it's 40 years since I saw it. I mean, my memory of it is the little conflicts within the family, how little disasters can, how much their life is on a knife edge, so that little disasters have major consequences. Mm. And I think a lot of the actors are the people from the region.
Really.
I think he's quite Catholic, I think he's quite religious, which I'm not, but he has I think what comes across is his affection and respect for the people in the film, and you feel that, and he gives them great dignity. And it was a big artistic success when it was made. I think it won the prize at Cannes, I think, and but also deeply political where we used to think in politics in party sense, but in trying to understand the situation of people in this situation, and the pressures and social context in which they live,
and they're making their way through the year, isn't it, and the seasons and
yes,
everything.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
And that sounds fascinating. Yes,
and there's a fragility to their existence, which is impressive.
So there's a piece of music by Johann Sebastian Bach, Fugue in G minor.
Thank you.
And you had a little story about the director here for us.
Yes, Amano Olmi, Italian director. He and I and an Iranian director called Abbas Kiarostami made a film in Italy, which was in three sections. We each did one section. And it was Kiarostami's idea that we should do it, and we met. And Olmi didn't... He lived near Bologna, and he was the oldest, and he didn't move very far. So we met several times before we did the project. And the main question was where we should meet. But every time we met near Amano Olmi's place, because that's where the good restaurants were that he wanted to eat. So it became more a discussion of food than films. But the funny thing was, what connected the three stories was that we tried to find a linking motif, and we decided it should be on a train. It'd be the same train, and there were three groups of passengers, and each group had a story. You know, fairly simple idea. And my questions were quite different to Olmi's. To Amano Olmi, it was just a train. It was like a mystical train. It could be going anywhere. It was just a train. For me, you know, being a kind of pedantic North European, I wanted to know where it started, what was its journey, what time of day was it in such a place, what was the real timetable, where was it going to, and that kind of, what was the real journey, and we couldn't. And he kept saying, it doesn't matter, it's just a train, it's going anywhere. And because he wanted his thing to happen at night.
Right.
But I couldn't find a journey that would fit, which had a night thing.
A real train journey.
Okay. And so, I mean, I was like a boring old social realist saying, you know, look, we've got to anchor this in some real journey. There wasn't really a meeting of minds on that. Olmi's train just went in and out of day or night according to his whim, whereas mine had to have meet a timetable of stations. So there was maybe the difference in a southern European and a northern one.
And what was the name of this film?
It's called Tickets.
Tickets.
Tickets, yes.
Ticket.
It's a collector's item rather than a compulsory game.
Excellent. Okay, so now moving on, the next thing here, which is something that is actually one of my late mother's favourite films, Jules et Jim, 1962. Yes. What a wonderful film. Directed by François Truffaut, composer Georges de la Rue, and let's just play the theme first and talk about it afterwards.
Yes.
The theme des vacances. was the Theme des Vacances from Jules et Jim. It's by François Truffaut, director, and the composer Georges de la Rue. Georges de la Rue, extremely prolific composer for films. He scored over 200 features and worked with most of the French New Wave directors. Le Figaro called him the Mozart of cinema, which is quite an accolade. He worked with Truffaut, Godard, René, Louis Malle, and then Bertolucci, Oliver Stone, etc., etc. So there's a remarkable body of work there from Georges de la Rue. You got something for us about this film?
Well, it's just a delightful film. I mean, it's the film everybody falls in love with, really. I mean, it's not unrelated to his young Jean Moreau cycling through the lanes of France. And, I mean, it's there's a kind of happiness in parts of the film that are just beguiling, aren't they? Mm. And the characters make you smile, make you care about them. And it's a lovely piece of filmmaking, I mean, I guess again for people my generation and younger, it's the kind of film that makes you fall in love with cinema.
Mm. Fabulous! What a nice sentiment that is. Mm-hmm. So our final piece today, sadly it's going to be the last piece of music we're going to play. You've picked another Czech New Wave film, this one by Miloš Forman, Loves of a Blonde from 1965. Now, that's out of your choices. That's three Czech New Wave films. And I wonder what it seems to be like, because they keep coming up. Something seems to be quite monumental about them as an influence on your work.
Yes, I think it was the style of filmmaking that I felt most drawn to. Mm. It's unemphatic, it's very humane, it's the humour of observation. It's about observation, it's about recognising the idiosyncrasies of people, how we behave with each other, the comedies of everyday life, and a kind of humorous tolerance. Mm. Mm. And I mean, they were made at a time when the old Stalinist oppression in Eastern Europe was very intense and very bullying. Mm. And this was a counterculture of warmth and humanity and
keep
comedy.
The spirits up.
Yes, and but of truth too. You know, the people were not the heroic tractor drivers. They were flawed, funny human beings.
And how did they get funding for these films?
Well, it was through through the Czech state.
Right.
But the films travelled and, you know, were popular and obviously made money. Mm. Whether they were seen to be profitable, I don't know, but they were certainly great successes certainly in Europe. But Loves of a Blonde, or A Blonde in Love, it's a lovely film. It's about a small town where the men of, mainly women, the men have either gone away to war, or they're just after the Second World War, the men have gone to other work in the cities, and there's a factory, and it's about factory girls, and they don't have any boyfriends, and there's some soldiers are going to be stationed there, so they're all park get excited about this idea of they're going to be young soldiers and they'll find boyfriends. When they come across, they're married men and they're elderly. Well, they're not elderly, but they're young middle-aged, and they're a bit paunchy, and they're not the boys of their dreams at all. And there's a beautiful scene where there's the local community, we'd call it community organizer now, I suppose, he arranges a dance for the factory girls and the soldiers, and they sit on either side of the hall and confront each other, and the disappointment is on both sides, and the comedy is the guys trying to chat up the girls, and one wrestles his wedding finger off his finger, and the ring rolls across the floor and lands underneath the table of one of the groups, the main group of girls, and so the poor guy has to come along and scrabble around their ankles to get his wedding ring, and it's just very funny, and the characters are beautifully drawn, but the main girl in it falls for the pianist in the band rather than
one of the soldiers.
Falls for a musician, you'll be pleased to hear. And and so it's really the story of a little, he spends the night with her and then she wants to track him down and goes back to his house, or his flat in Prague, I guess it is, and is viewed with, he's not there, of course, he's out on a gig with other girls, and she's viewed with great suspicion by the mother, and it's a very delicate, funny, beautiful little film by Milos Forman.
So here we have the end theme from Loves of a Blonde, director Milos Forman, unknown composer, and it's performed by Evzin Ilin.
Tatínek je hrozně hodnej, víš, takový. Prostě hodnej. A kdy tam zase pojedeš? Tam budu jezdit teď. Pořád, no.
Was the end theme from Loves of a Blonde, directed by Milos Forman, performed by Evzin Ilin. Well, Ken, it's been a wonderful opportunity to meet you and talk about film and film soundtracks with you. Thank you so much for coming in, and I wish you all the best. With your, are you on a new project now?
Well, we're scratching around.
Anything you can say about now?
No, I'm not sure what it's going to be. I mean, I thought... We did the last one. I thought I'm not sure I've got any more petrol left in the tank, really. But it's a young man's job. But yeah. I don't know. I think we'll have to have a go one more. I'm scratching around with the writer I work with, Paul Laverty, and see if we can come up with something that isn't too demanding. But thanks a lot, Hugh. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, I'm delighted you could make it.
Yeah, and you can see that. I mean, the films that I like, they have a kind of lightness of texture and a kind of delicacy about them. I don't know if you're the same, but like the shorter, the lighter, the more airborne the films are, the less dragged down by weight and heavy soundtracks, the better, really, for me.
Good. Well, thank you very much again. All the best with your future works.
Thanks so much, and to you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.